Good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, June 19th, and we are at a new section in our Politics of Exclusion series, and this next series is going to be called Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox, which, you know, is a wonderful topic, and I know some people here might be asking the first two obvious questions of who, what, and why. Who is Saul Lieberman? You know, what do you mean by Orthodox? And why are we having this discussion? These are all questions which are going to be answered in due time. To give just a very, very brief introduction as to why I wanted to do Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox, it is all based off of this book by Mark Shapiro titled Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. At roughly 50 pages, this is, for my money, one of the most important books on modern Judaism that you will ever find. And the reason being is he's going to tackle the question that we're going to discuss, obviously, because it's based off of his writings. And I should point out that even though that we are going to be doing extensive citations from this book, it is very much worthwhile to read through everything in detail, because it is a wonderful piece of scholarship. The footnotes are fantastic. And he also reprints original letters in the back. And this would, certainly for any sort of modern Judaism, this ought to be a required reading. At 50 pages, it's not a long read. But what I think it will help show is what we've been discussing in the past several weeks, especially dealing with the conservative movement. I mean, we were focusing on Rav Moshe Feinstein. Here we're going to look at it from the opposite direction of being excluded from Judaism by means of certain affiliations that have nothing to do with your own personal observance or knowledge. So to give a very brief summary, and we will expand on this, on Saul Lieberman and why this is, I think, a fascinating question. Saul Lieberman was a professor of Talmud at the Jewish Theological Seminary. He was also an undisputed world-renowned scholar and Talmudist. I brought some of his works here. This is a combination of two works, Greek and Jewish Palestine and Hellenism in Jewish Palestine. Highly recommended reading for everyone if you can get a copy of this. Where things, although that, you know, might be, you may be able to relegate that to just pure academic scholarship, of which it is, you know, really highest caliber. He's also well known for a set that I brought here called Tosefta Kifshuta, not the whole set if you're listening, just two volumes of it. What this is, it's a critical, I guess it makes sense if you look at it, you know, one volume at a time. One volume comes as a critical edition of the Tosefta based on manuscripts. And some brief comments in the first volume. Then there's a corresponding volume to each one of these where he writes a detailed commentary based on scholarship, based on Yerushalmi, a really phenomenal piece of work. And I would say that it's probably the best work you will find in the Tosefta today, and it probably will remain unsurpassed because no one does that much scholarship on the Tosefta. And being a brilliant Talmudist, was able to integrate, not just knowing, you know, Shas, backwards and forwards, knew Greek and knew the Greek culture. He also knew the Yerushalmi, knew how to do all these parallelisms. And it is a phenomenal body of work, such that if anyone is doing any research on the Tosefta, you really have to check up and see if Lieberman said anything on what you're about to say.
Was there a reason he did Tosefta and not Mishnah and Braita?
That is a wonderful, wonderful question. And I can't answer that, but I would recommend that you ask my father that, because that's something that he's done some work on. So the answer is probably yes. And my my father gave the Lieberman lecture at UTJ either last year, I think it was last year even, or perhaps 2 years ago. And he spoke a little bit about that topic. I wonder if it's online. So if you are interested in his thoughts, and my father is a much... knows Saul Lieberman's work much better than I do. I don't believe he took a class with Saul Lieberman, but Saul Lieberman was still around when he was there. So here's where we get to an interesting, you know, issue. For most rabbis, you could easily dismiss them and say, oh, he's a conservative. And let's face it, most rabbis around today, I would say myself included, do very little that's really worthwhile for people to follow. It's like, oh, I absolutely need what this person does. And for me, I think the closest thing would be the Jewish guitar chords. You know, I could just as easily see someone saying, well, given that Rabbi Yehuda's a heretic, can you still use his guitar chords? I'm sure that's going to happen at some point in the future. But for the most part, you know, there are things that I, you know, write, there are things that I say, I'm very easy to ignore. For someone like Saul Lieberman, who is, you know, such a wonder, you know, fantastic Talmudist, and the people who are honest and know what they're doing would certainly respect his intellectual acumen, realize that he has a great deal to contribute, case in point on the Tosefta. So what do you do in such a case? Because it seems that his only real avera, so to speak, was accepting the appointment to teach Talmud at JTS. So that is a question that's is really elaborated on at length in this book, and we'll see it in we will deal with it. Yeah.
I mean, he's an Orthodox rabbi who got a gig at JTS, is that?
For lack of a better term, yeah. I mean, that's an easy way of simply putting it. So we're going to approach that same question of exclusion, but from the other angle. Instead of just, Rav Moshe Feinstein's opinion regarding the whole institution, what about one particular individual who happened to have been affiliated that on a case-by-case basis, right, it would be very hard, how do you go about saying that this person, how do you deal with such an individual? And that is going to be the topic of the next 3 weeks. And what I think we're going to see is that, really the major reason for exclusion was because of his employment and his affiliation, more than any bit of his Torah. But people, we struggled with that question. And we can come to, different conclusions when we finish the whole series. All right? Very quick questions, because we haven't started yet. Yeah.
Isn't this similar to what we discussed a week or two ago? A plain Jew taking an appointment at a Talmud Torah?
I would say it's a little bit different because he's teaching at JTS. And someone teaching at JTS is very different than teaching at a Talmud Torah. Great point. For those who were in follow last week, Rav Moshe Feinstein, we did a show from Rav Moshe Feinstein, who permitted an Orthodox Jew to teach at a Talmud Torah. But here, when you're teaching in JTS, which is the rabbinical school, we'll also see later on in the book a possible distinction between Saul Lieberman, who is a professor of Talmud, who might have taught future rabbis, versus someone who is actually a teacher in the rabbinics program. It sounds like a semantic difference, but organizationally in JTS, it probably did make a huge difference. Yes?
It seems like it's more than just exclusion. It's just schism between two groups who have different points of view, and I can't accept Saul Lieberman teaching in that kind of an institution because he contaminates everything or us as well.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're going to be doing. And that's a type of exclusion. But the point of exclusion, again, is focused less on what it is that you do, less on what it is that you believe, and more what team do you decide to play for. There you go. So, Egg, do you please start us off with source number one? All of the sources that we're citing here are from Shapiro's book, and the numbers at the end of the citations are the page numbers.
While it might have been possible to find an instructor in history from outside the Orthodox community, instructors in Talmud were much more difficult to locate. After all, where else but among the Orthodox did young men devote themselves to the study of rabbinic literature and rise to the level of experts, thus making them worthy of training future rabbis? It is, therefore, no surprise that the various non-Orthodox seminaries look to the Orthodox. These institutions were willing to respect the Orthodox faculty members' religious autonomy, that is, they would not force them to violate their religious principles. The assumption of the directors of these seminaries, soon to be proven correct, was that there would be members of the Orthodox scholarly elite who, for financial or perhaps even idealistic reasons, would be willing to instruct students at their institutions.
So to just give a background, you can easily ask, well, why would a conservative seminary hire an Orthodox rabbi? The answer simply being, well, they were good. Meaning the people who are able to teach Talmud well probably were Orthodox themselves, and they would be good instructors. And since, as they say here, financial or idealistic, forget the idealistic for a second, because that can confuse matters, in terms of, getting into someone's head about what it is they believe and what it is they don't believe. But certainly for financial reasons, teaching Talmud, yes, it is a, wonderful skill, it's a great religious skill, but it's not a wonderfully marketable skill. So if you have an institution that can pay you and you get to teach Talmud, hopefully to bright students, that's a really, tempting job offer pretty much anyone. All right, take paragraph two.
It's always been easy for the Orthodox public at large to ignore those who teach at non-Orthodox seminaries, even if these men are completely observant. Yet it is not so easy for Orthodox scholars to ignore their work. On the one hand, they are regarded as having cast their lot with the non-Orthodox. On the other hand, their work is often valuable even to the most close-minded of the Orthodox. The problem, therefore, presents itself. How should Orthodox scholars relate to those who teach at non-Orthodox seminaries? This is obviously not an issue that concerns those Orthodox who pursue academic Jewish studies, but is indeed relevant to those who are involved in traditional Talmud study. For many of them, the issue is, to put it bluntly, is one permitted to cite the Torah insights of those who are regarded as having left Orthodoxy?
Now, keep in mind here, it says having left Orthodoxy. The implication is that by accepting a position at the school, you have left Orthodoxy. Right, which may or may not be true, right? But it certainly would resonate with the perception. All right. Continue. Yeah.
Could you explain the previous sentence? It's obviously not an issue that's concerned.
Right. So if you're pursuing academic Judaic studies, meaning you want to be a professor, even then people will be able to make a certain distinction in terms of what are you doing as an academic subject versus what it is that you believe. This may come up a bit, say, if you're doing, let's say you want to do a PhD in Bible. If you want to do a PhD in Bible at any normal, I shouldn't say normal, at any halfway decent university, you're going to be exposed to biblical criticism. You're going to have to know biblical criticism. Right? These are things that you just have to do in order to advance or do anything in your field. Right? Now, there would be people who object to that, but there would certainly be a huge distinction between learning biblical criticism as an academic subject versus buying into it completely as a theological standpoint that you might find in a rabbinical school where you're sort of combining the two. Right? So that would be a distinction. Or to give another distinction, if someone who's Orthodox and I know I might be opening up a can of worms here. Let's say someone wants to do a PhD in biology, right? You can't do a PhD in biology unless, you know, you do something with the theory of evolution. It's kind of important, right? Now, from people go into biology and people don't, you know, question them, oh, do you believe in evolution or do you not? I am not going to get into it all here, you know, the role of evolution in Jewish thought, what works and what doesn't. But the point is people go into medicine. Well, I'm not sure if med school is, you know, how important theory of evolution is. What?
Genetics, that's all involved.
Both? Okay. So certainly if you, you know, do something in genetics, you're going to have to operate under those assumptions. No pun intended. I really mean that. That wasn't intended. But certainly if you're going to do a PhD in biology, you would. And you don't find people say, like, okay, that's because, you know, it's an academic subject, but people don't get really into what is it that he's doing. You know, what does this person think or believe? It's more of a trade. Now, do people still make that distinction? Maybe yes, maybe no, but it's a much easier distinction to make, right, than to say, oh, yeah, that's what they're doing because that's what you have to do to get your degree. All right? Continue. And now, Shapiro cites some particular examples.
Mayer took the kernel and started the shell, i.e. he only took what was religiously acceptable from Elisha ben Avuya.
/Acher. Anything in the brackets I included. So first example that he cites is, you know, so go back to the Talmud, which I believe we covered in this class, of, you know, it came to Acher if Mayer kept his Torah and threw away everything else. Okay?
Ibn Ezra had no compunctions about citing Keretz. Earlier, Rabbi Haigoin wished and lists of Christian clerics' assistance in understanding the meaning of the biblical text and rebuked the Dayan, Rabbi Matzliya ben Albasek, when he expressed his reluctance to be involved in such a request. These luminaries were following the tradition later formulated by Maimonides in his introduction to the Shmona Brachim to accept the truth from wherever it comes.
So there is certainly some precedent within the Jewish tradition of accepting truth from heretical sources. Again, not by implication saying that, you know, Sully was a heretic, not at all, but you could almost make a kal v'chomer. That since there is some precedent behind it, you know, there is room to say, well, even though we disagree with, you know, everything else he may do, he did some stuff of value, and to take that at face value, even, you know, for matters of Torah study. All right, continue. So here's an example, and also for the sources that he quote, that he cited, Shapiro does provide footnotes, so please buy the book and look it up. However, there are also some other examples in the more contemporary period of how did people, what were some other examples of, you know, when people cited others who might have been considered heretical, there was also another approach. Dan, please take source number 4.
To present a concrete illustration, Rav Zacharia Frankel wrote a commentary, Ahavat Zion, on Brachot, Peah, and Damai of the Jerusalem Talmud. When a traditional Talmudist studies and writes about these tractates, how will he relate to Frankel's commentaries? While we do find some traditionalists who held a positive view of Frankel, most Talmudists who have heard of his commentary ignore it, regarding it as possible invalid because of its authorship. Others use Frankel's work without ever mentioning his name or the name of his commentary. They might refer to an interpretation advanced by a Chacham Echad, one wise person, or perhaps they simply incorporate the interpretation into their own work without any acknowledgement of their plagiarism. In Rabbi Nadin Steinsaltz's edition of Jerusalem Talmud Peah, he came up with his own solution. Explanations are cited in the name of
Zion Peh, yeah,
the Hebrew initials of Zacharia Frankel. The letter R, standing for rabbi, is conspicuously omitted. Even more interesting is that in Steinsaltz's list of abbreviations, there is no explanation given for Zion Peh. In addition, there is no reference to Ahavat Zion in the long list of sources cited at the end of the book. In other words, the intelligent will understand, Hamevin Yavin, but the typical yeshiva student will not.
So you got a couple, yeah. So here are a couple of solutions which, you know, again, Shapiro documents. One is simply you plagiarize and you don't give attribution. Another is you can do so very subtly, where you give credit, but only in a way that the people who know what you're doing are going to appreciate the source, and other people, you know, don't. So you are, on one hand, showing that there is value to the scholarship without giving any honor to the individual. All right? Here's what he put it in a footnote here, which I'll explain why he included this. George, take source number 5. This is in a footnote off of the previous paragraph.
Good example of the subtle plagiarism in regard to another book is the B'nai Barak 1977 edition of Rabbi Aryeh Leib Heller, the Shev
Shematata.
Called Shev Shematata HaShalom, and contain novella by Rabbi Moses Sternbach. In the introduction written by Mendel, Menachem Mendel Berlitz, there's an essay on Heller's method of study. Virtually the entire essay has been lifted word for word from Rav Seder's Toldot HaPaskim, New York 1947. In 1998, Nelson David Rabinovich published a book intended for yeshiva students entitled M. Melsnina Talmudic Terminology. On the title page, it says that this book has been adapted by Rabinovich, yet anyone who examines Melsnina's Introduction to the Talmud, New York 1967, will see that, with the exception of a few added notes, Rabinovich has reprinted the entire third part of Melsner's book. Rabinovich never informs the reader that Moses Melsner, who lived in 1828 to 1903, was a Reform rabbi as well as a professor of Talmud at the Hebrew Union College, where he also served as president from 1900 to 1903. I guess it's Shapiro.
I too, meaning Shapiro is now writing from his own personal experience.
To have experienced something similar. Much of Daniel Stein's lengthy note,
La'asuke shematata aliba dehilchata.
Okay, thank you. Beit Yitzchak, 35, 2003, page 695, 692.
Note 5.
Is taken without acknowledgement from my article, The Brisker Method Reconsidered.
And he gives the citation.
Tradition 31, yeah. Spring 19.
Okay, next sentence.
Stein even refers to an unpublished letter of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, that I cited without ever informing the reader of his source.
Yeah. Now, the reason why I want to include this in here, I mean, first off, you know, to have more examples of, like, when such plagiarism can occur, certainly in the first section, you know, really, you know, it reinforces it. The second part is, I think, fascinating for a whole lot of reasons, and for this, need to know a little bit of, you know, YU history, or at least, you know, political stuff that went down when I was there. The Beit Yitzchak is the journal published by the student organization of Yeshiva. It's written in Hebrew, mostly by students, rabbis, faculty, people, and the like. I personally had a great issue with this article, Alasuke Shematata Liba de Hilchata. Daniel Stein wrote two articles that year, one of which made the blogosphere back then, which, you know, was a much bigger deal because, you know, there were just fewer Jewish sites, on Lo Tirtzach, not applying to non-Jews. Meaning if you kill a non-Jew, you don't violate Lo Tirtzach. That was one piece, and a lot of people harped on that. I was in Chicago at the time, and Stephen I. Weiss sent me a copy of that article and a copy of this article, which I took major umbrage at for many, many, many reasons. If anyone is interested, you can search my website, joshuter.com, for a post titled The Stein Line, and you can see just what my issues were. What's interesting about the citation of the Beit Yitzchak, and I don't know if Shapiro knew of this or probably didn't bother citing, is that Saul Lieberman himself was the subject of a controversy only a few years earlier. How could that be? A friend of mine, Rabbi Dr. Eliyahu Stern, who actually spoke in this shul about a month or so ago, had written an article for this Beit Yitzchak journal. He cited Saul Lieberman, and he appended, he gave him the title of Grash, which is what some of his students call him, of Gaon Rav Saul Lieberman. And apparently, people took major, major, major umbrage with that. Copies of the Beit Yitzchak disappeared, and in subsequent years, it became under more editorial control. So, it's interesting. You know, it's an interesting anecdote. You know, to throw in here as he's citing, you know, an example of, you know, people not necessarily giving credit. Whether or not, you know, Daniel Stein wrote this article without attribution because he thought Shapiro was a heretic, I doubt that. You know, the Beit Yitzchak is not really, you know, a scholarly article, journal. I'm sorry if you like these. It's not scholarship. It's sometimes, more often than not, people are writing up word surf hikers that they heard in, you know, Sheer. But at any rate, it's something to, it's something I find interesting, and especially throwing in an example of Beit Yitzchak that only a few years earlier had its own issue giving kavod to Saul Lieberman. Anyway, slide aside there.
Where's Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's, where is he on the spectrum? Would Rabbi Feinstein prove it?
I have no idea. I'm not going to
accept it.
I have no idea who accepts him. I'm certainly not going to read into Rav Moshe's mind. But Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, to my knowledge, doesn't teach at any alternate denominational schools, or at least not as a Rosh Yeshiva. Just because I don't think people got puzzled just because they were academics. And look, Rav Soloveitchik had a PhD. Were there some? Look, if you're going to ask if there were some people who disqualified him automatically because Rav Soloveitchik had a PhD, probably. You know, what do they want to say for that? Maybe that was enough. But certainly for the YU world, having a PhD is not an intrinsic psul. Okay, that much I can say without certainty. I can say without any doubt, with absolute certainty. Well, yeah.
Do you want to explain the title? The Shiv Shematita?
I don't want to get into that. All right. So number six, source number six, we start getting into, well, that sort of sets the stage a little bit in terms of how did, what were some of the ways that Orthodox could react to scholarship, or specifically Torah scholarship, written from people with whom you may disagree or consider them, you know, beyond the pale, ranging from accept the truth from whom you hear to, you know, cite it very inconspicuously or, you know, as tactfully as possible, so that the right people know what you're doing and the wrong people won't get offended. Two, just plain outright plagiarism. All right. Now, in terms of, you know, the world, the religious world that Lehrman came into, Shapiro writes, there was no question that until his move to the seminary, referring to JTS, Lieberman was firmly ensconced in Orthodox society and recognized as a future Gadol B'Yisrael. During this time, referring to before he left to America, we know he enjoyed a very close relationship with Abraham Isaac Cook, and the two of them often studied together. We also find that Ben Sion Uziel, the Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, addressed him in an extremely complimentary fashion. Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski also referred to him in a very positive way, and his cousin, Rav Aram Karelitz, the Chazon Ish, wrote to him discussing some textual points of the Tosefta, while also criticizing the academic study for Talmud for its focus on philology and history. In another letter, he acknowledges the correctness of a Talmudic point made by Lieberman. So with these sources, again, all cited by Shapiro, before Lieberman took the position at JTS, you would consider him as Orthodox as they would come, to the point where he would engage in correspondence and taken seriously by, I would say, very prominent Orthodox leaders, or if not Orthodox leaders, leaders within Orthodox Judaism, that, you know, whose credentials would, in terms of being Orthodox, would be unquestioned. All right, and he seems to be in that world before he leaves for America. All right, and take us to source number 7.
The period when Lieberman came to the seminary was one of increased battles between Orthodox and conservatives, as both were competing for the loyalty of a large segment of the American Jewish community.
All right, so we've discussed this point before about competition sort of creating or fostering animus. That if they're not a threat to you, you could safely ignore them. But here was a time when there was actual competition for the hearts and minds of the Jewish people in America.
The conservative rabbinate had recently begun to assert its independence in the areas of halakhic decision-making, most vividly in the 1935 approval of Rabbi Louis Epstein's proposal to send the Agunav problem at the time of marriage, the husband couldn't appoint his wife as his agent, so that if necessary, she could later write to get herself under the supervision of a Beit Din. Shapiro, page 3. Proposal rejected by the Orthodox rabbinate with particular vehemence. Rabbi Joseph Konvitz, president of Agudat HaRabbanim of the United States and Canada, spoke for his colleagues when he declared, "The students from Schechter's seminary have absolutely no connection to the rabbinate and halakhic decision-making." Agudat HaRabbanim went so far as to proclaim that anyone who made use of Epstein's proposal, including the bride, the groom, and even the witnesses, were to be placed in chairman. I think he should have burned them alive. You know?
Well, editorialize after. Just keep to the text for now.
I couldn't resist. This proclamation was signed by hundreds of American rabbis, including such renowned figures as Bernard Revel.
Yeah.
Moses Soloveitchik and Zev Gold, as to what led the conservatives to think they can involve themselves in such an important halakhic area. An editorial in Harpardes answers as follows. "You must confess and say we are guilty. They have found among us rabbis who respect them, who come together with them to be misader kedushin."
Need to officiate their weddings. Misader kedushin, officiate their wedding officiants.
"Or at other gatherings. There are those of us who went to their synagogues. They are those of us who educated our children in their seminary. And this is what brought about their chutzpah to establish themselves as rabbis, to rule in halakhot of gittin and kedushin, divorce and marriage."
To stop here for a second. So, as Shapiro writes, it wasn't just a matter of hearts and minds competition, but you now had the conservative movement, or rabbis affiliated with the conservative movement, actually paskening halakha and offering different halakhic rulings not in line with what the Orthodox were doing. right? And that seems to be more of a direct encroachment onto, you know, what they might have considered, well, this is our area. You know, as long as you stick to your own thing, like, fine. But once you start doing something significant, now we have to start getting worried about it. And again, it depends on what side you're on. If you're on the Orthodox side, this is a huge game changer. If you're on the conservative side, it's like, well, what's the big deal? It's like, you know, so please don't read too much into my words, because a lot of it's going to depend on what side you're on. If you're, you know, you have more of an affinity to the conservatives, so you can say, well, wow, this is just a turf war. That once there's an encroachment, then, you know, we're going to put you down. You know, once there's encroachment, you're, you know, starting to attack us. And from the Orthodox side, you can say, well, up until now, you were relatively harmless. Once you start engaging in halakha, you can now actively trip up people. And according to this editorial in Hapardes, the problem is that too many Orthodox rabbis gave them respect. Right? You know, it's almost like, you know, you start treating people with respect, eventually they think that they're, you know, worthy of respect. Right? But continue.
In fact, our Pardes itself seems to have been guilty in this regard as well. For in 1931, it actually published the Torah note by Louis Finkelstein. Despite the fact that he had taught in the seminary since 1924 and was president of the Rabbinical Assembly from 1828 to 1930.
Right.
Long-lived guy.
Yeah, but I mean, also, and the pointer of the statement is, well, in this editorial in Harper's Days, it says, you know, you're taking, you know, it's our fault for taking rabbis too seriously. You know, I mean, the truth is, the language of the editorial is we, which is inclusive as opposed to you. So it could also be acknowledging that, yeah, we made a mistake back then. But I think what, you know, Shapiro does show is that even Harper's Days, that came out so critical, did at one point accept submissions from those who were clearly affiliated conservatives. Continue.
The following is another example of this guilt. After Epstein published his first pamphlet detailing his solution to the Laguna problem, he sent it to Orthodox rabbis around the world soliciting their reactions. While rabbis in Europe who responded were unaware of Epstein's denominational affiliation, this was not the case for Rabbi Samuel Gerstenfeld, Rabbi Jacob Kantrowitz, and Rabbi Joseph Elijah Henkin. Yet all of these men, each one a notable figure in American Orthodoxy, replied to Epstein in terms reserved for colleagues.
And I've included here in the brackets from his footnotes, Harav HaGaon or Moreinu Harav.
Seeing himself referred to in this fashion, Epstein would obviously be justified in assuming that he was regarded as an equal member of the rabbinic fraternity.
Yeah. Right? So, you know, where did he get the chutzpah from to think that he was actually a rav? Well, from all of these people who treated him as a rav. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, keep in mind also, you know, rabbis throughout the years have said, you know, collectively, individually, you can find some rabbis that have said some really crazy types of things. And often, if a rabbi says something off the wall, you can either reject it or dismiss it. But it takes a lot to just say, you know, oh, wow, this is now something we really have to be aware of and start nipping this in the bud and just, you know, excising this person completely from community. Anything take source number 8 here?
In truth, the guilt of which Hapardes spoke is completely understandable. For when dealing with the first half of the 20th century, the designation conservative or Orthodox Jew does not denote fundamental differences among much of the American Jewish laity, congregations, and even among many of the rabbis. Indeed, it was precisely the Epstein proposal that awakened the Orthodox rabbi to the possibility that conservatives would begin to make far-reaching halakhic decisions independently, something they had refrained from doing until then. This explains why the conservative movement came to be regarded as a real danger only in the 1930s. Until then, one would often be hard-pressed to distinguish between the two movements, since in many Orthodox synagogues, i.e. synagogues which were part of the Orthodox Union, men and women sat together, and most members of Orthodox synagogues had the exact same religious makeup as members of the conservative synagogues.
And we actually saw this cited in Rav Moshe too, and he made a reference to being more accepting of an Orthodox denomination synagogue that didn't have a kosher mechitza. Right, his words. Remember, you know, right? So there, and that was even much later. right? Right. So here you have, again, if you just look at the, you know, ground of like who, what was going on, they were virtually indistinguishable, except it was only in the 30s did conservative movements start, you know, really start getting into the public halachic sphere. Another issue of competition. Dan, source number 9.
The tension between the two movements was increased by the fact that many talented members of the Orthodox community were choosing to attend the seminary to receive ordination, rather than REITs,
which stands for Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University,
or another yeshiva, and there were no appreciable gains in the other direction. In fact, in a survey of applicants to the JTS Rabbinical School covering the years 1946 to 57, it was revealed that 60% came from Orthodox homes and 30% were graduates of Yeshiva College. There is every reason to think that the numbers were not much different in the previous decade. Because the conservatives defined themselves as faithfully following tradition, the Orthodox regarded them as a real threat.
Yeah.
And thus more dangerous than the Reform. Indeed, most observers at the time believed that Orthodoxy was on its way out, while conservatism was the wave of the future. As such, it can be imagined what a shock it was for the Orthodox when, in 1940, the internationally renowned Jerusalem Illui, prodigy of genius, Saul Lieberman, accepted an invitation to join the seminary faculty. This was a great coup for the seminary, and with both Louis Ginsburg and Lieberman on the faculty, the seminary became the world center of academic Talmudic scholarship.
Yeah. Right, so this helps put it, you know, when we kept talking about the competition, not only was it, you know, for the hearts and minds of the laity, you start talking about Piskei Halacha, so your influence is going to more of just like, you know, if a rabbi gets up and gives a drush in shul, I mean, I don't know what things were like in the 30s, but you're not going to really affect it that many people. When you start issuing big proclamations in the halachic sphere, then you already have to, you know, start being, you know, a little bit more aware, well, what are they talking about? But also just in terms of attendance, JTS at this point seem to have been doing better than REITs, right? So you had the Orthodox that seemed to think, well, here's what we represent. There's another group that seems to be labeling itself as following tradition. They seem to be winning. So it makes sense, if you're on the Orthodox side, why you would start to get incredibly nervous as to your own movement's viability, right? And when Lieberman came over, as it says here, what a shock it was for the Orthodox, right? Because you have your, you know, sense, if not on the ropes, you're definitely seeing yourself as in a very tough fight. And that, you know, this kind of helps set the stage for what actually happened when he came in and what were the reactions to his work afterwards, right? Because beforehand, you know, by all accounts, he was still Shomer Shabbos, and he actually you know, describes in the book that you know, Saul Lieberman was still Orthodox. Not everyone in the JTS would have been considered observant, or have, you might call, traditional theologies, even or ideologies, even back at that time. But you couldn't say that about Saul Lieberman.
He was
a student at the time. He wasn't actually a... We're talking about the... In the 40s? W. Weiss Olivier, I believe, studied under Saul Lieberman, or at least, you know, might have, you know, been a contemporary in, you know, some way, but I don't think... You know, yes, I mean, you could argue about that too, but it would come a little bit later. At least with Saul Lieberman, you know, he was there, and he was still considered... I also don't know if W. Weiss Olivier was that prominent in the Orthodox world before he came over, where Saul Lieberman clearly was. So for him to be renowned in Orthodox and then take a position in a conservative institution could easily be construed as a defection. Right?
As a footnote, Conowitz, who's America Rabbi in the United States in Canada, is responsible for us not having an error.
Really? Huh.
There's a... I'll show you the sheet that he had a number of people sign. A rabbi sign that there cannot be an error.
What year was that?
Was way back. And there's a question about even David Feinstein whether that was really his signature.
All right. Seth, all right. Interesting footnote. If anyone wants to, you know, have a share on like Aravin and the Lurie side, you'll come back to me when we're done with this. I'm aware. You know, I read the stories about that. At any rate, you know, so this, I think, it starts help setting the stage for exactly what were the tensions that he faced. And I think Shapiro does a wonderful job of presenting this in the political realm that it is. Right, because if he himself, you know, was a Talmid Chacham, which you can't write Tosefta Kefshuta back then without a CD, without being a Talmid Chacham. And I say that because the more that I do work, you know, with a Bar Ilan CD-ROM, the more I'm in awe of, you know, any rabbi or scholar, academic scholar who came before me, who is able to do pretty much what I'm doing, but had to do it either from memory or like do well indexed. You know, index cards and everything cross-referenced, or have it all in my head, have it all in their head. I mean, for me, I, you know, go through Shas in a matter of seconds. You know, for them, you know, so you don't put together Tosefta Kefshuta if you're stupid. So clearly he was brilliant. Clearly he was from, but he did the cardinal sin of taking a position at JTS. In the next couple of weeks, we'll talk about some of the ramifications, you know, that came out of that. How did the Orthodox world, or what were some of the ways that the Orthodox world addressed this perceived defection? Right. Have a wonderful week.